All right, we are recording. This is Jen Brown. I'm here in Lamar, Texas with Chuck Nazer to record an oral history with him about his life and work. And it is February 12th, 2020, yes. 2022. For the record, do I have your permission to record?
You do.
Okay, great. Well, since this is an oral history, the best starting point here is, can you tell me more about your background and early life?
I've got a long early life.
Okay, you know, from the beginning.
From the beginning.
Or however much you want to tell me.
I was born a Rockefeller and they switched me in the crib, so I had to work. I was born in Mobile, Alabama at Brookley Air Force Base during World War II. And, you know, immediately came to Texas, where I grew up in a little town called East Bernard, which is a German, Bohemian, Czech farming community outside of Houston. And my father was superintendent of schools and had a lot of respect for him. He was an orphan at early age and went on and educated himself, and always admired him. Grew up hunting, fishing, and being a student, because Dad wanted to make sure I did that, whether I wanted to or not. You know, just a wonderful, rich, cultural upbringing in a community of people who, at that time, people cared for each other, you know. I had a lot of parents. My parents were all in that community because if I did something wrong, Mother and Daddy heard about it. So I was kind of a marked kid in that regard. But it, you know, it's what's missing out of life today, but I don't want to get off on that deal. But it was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. At the time, I didn't think so because there were neighboring towns that were a little bit bigger that had a whole lot of more pretty girls in it. And so I thought, well, I'd like to live over there, but you reflect back on it and you say, nah, I was in the right place.
Mm-hmm. And so you fished a lot. Did you fly fish growing up or?
No, there was no, I mean, we had farm ponds and creeks and we catfished with throw lines and, you know, through worms and bass, and if you caught a 2-pound one, it was really big, and that was basically what I did. The fly fishing, I remember I ordered a fly tying kit out of a comic book, and I ordered several things out of comic books that were comic. They weren't very functional, but they got my $1.35, so... No, I didn't do the fly fishing back then.
Mm-hmm. When did you get into saltwater fishing?
When I was growing up, I had an uncle who had a boat, and about once every 2 years would come I'm sorry, I got distracted here with this computer, but we'd come to the coast one or two times, and every time I came to the coast, I was intrigued by the idea that I never knew what I was going to catch or how big it was. I went to a farm pond. I knew I was going to catch a black bass. It was going to be 1 pound to 2 pounds. I knew it. And so the excitement came when I got around all the other species. Then I met my wife playing bridge at college. And her folks were diehard saltwater fishermen. She was really cute. She brought me to Rockport from while we were dating. And she's good. She really is. I mean, I'm going like, God, this gal's beautiful and she can fish. I'm in, I'm hooked.
You know? Where did you all go to college?
At Sam Houston State University in Huntsville. And I walked in a room and there were four gals sitting around that table. And I looked at her. That was it.
And you've been together ever since?
53 years, yeah.
Do you have children?
I have one son, Clay, who is in Pearland. He is reliability engineering manager at a huge refinery in Baytown.
Okay. And so what happened when you two graduated?
She went to Houston, and I finished up my school. And we just got married. You know, there wasn't any sense wasting a bunch of time. So we were there in Houston. She taught and I sold insurance. Mm-hmm. I never did follow my biology. I do more biology work now than I ever did.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So how did you get to Rockport?
Her dad and Marguerite, my wife, we call her Geet, G-E-T-E. Marguerite's a long, awkward name. So we would go floundering on the weekend. So we'd come down. You know what floundering is? Walk around with a lantern and a gig and, you know, don't step on a stingray, but stick a flounder. So we would do that a lot on the weekends. And we had a choice of either fishing up in the northern part of the state, up in Matagorda Bay or Galveston or wherever, or come to Rockport. And the water was so much more beautiful down here, so we just said, let's just go to Rockport. So Geet had an uncle that lived here, Emmett House, who loved for us to come down here, so we'd go stay with him. And just, you know, we never wore out our welcome, but we sure we had a great time coming down here. So the choice was to come to Rockport was based upon the water quality, amongst other things in there. And so we got to where we were traveling to Rockport. Oh, in the 70s, we came here 40 weekends a year. And we bought a house in 80 and moved here full-time in 92.
Okay. And can you describe, when did you first come to Rockport and what was it like back then?
Well, it was 1967. That's when I came here. She brought me down here. You know, you have to be careful how you answer that question. I do. My wife jumps on me all the time because I just say, well, there wasn't anybody here. I mean, but that's the truth. There was a culture of people locally who fished, but not very many. And then the weekenders were not very many. So you came down here and you basically were by yourself in all of this water. I mean, I'm telling you, you could come here on July 4th weekend, and if you saw another boat, you were, God, where'd that come from? So you had this solemn atmosphere to work in, or environment to work in, and just unimpeded by anybody else. I mean, God, it was glorious. And I don't resent the people that come here now. I mean, because they're just, I mean, there are a lot of people coming to Rockport and all over the coast for a lot of reasons. But I don't own any of this place. I can't tell people, and I don't want to tell people. I want them to see what I've seen. And then they'll be better stewards of it. I guess I got off track there, but it was like, after I started guiding daily and thinking about all of this stuff and just over years putting it all together, I would think back to what I first saw and how that had changed. And I thought, what did the Indians see? You know, if you think back 10 years, think back 200 years. And how all of these connections and creeks and islands and shorelines have changed. And you go out at night over into Mesquite Bay, and there's no other sound, and there's no light pollution, and you think, what a sight, what a heaven on earth for the Karankawa Indians. What did they see? No, they had no high lines, no light pollution, no sound. Water was pure. It just, excuse me. That was all part of what was here, was today and then the past. I love Rockport, I do. I'm just lucky. I think if everybody could have witnessed what I did in its purest forms, they would think more of the resource. They would protect it more. But I realized after a while, going back to the Indian deal, I realized truthfully what I saw in 1967 was the end of what they had witnessed.
And how would you describe it to someone like me who wasn't there at the time?
The feeling, the...
Yeah, what it looked like, how it felt. Yeah.
Well, the water was... The water was different in that... I hate to just jump right into this oyster deal, but this water was beautiful all the time. And winds might disturb it for a day, but not for weeks, in terms of turbidity. There were very few duck blind structures. It was in its natural form. The shell reefs were healthy. They were the results of eons of growth, and the vegetation was far different. I can think back to so many things that have evolved over time. It troubles me because I think what we had here was far better than what we have now. And I'm working, you know, you can't change this, but you can try to make a difference in what the next step is going to be.
Mm-hmm. So,
but it's just like if you went to any department store that really excited you, and you walked in, and there was nobody there to interfere with your shopping, and you could have anything you want and walk out of there free without breaking a law. You know, it just, that's really it. I mean, I don't want to get ahead of the game here, but part of my feeling today is that I learned in God's laboratory, unimpeded by anyone else. And I don't mean that necessarily like it sounds. I could go to a place and observe everything in there and not have it changed by the presence of somebody else passing through. And God bless them. I already said I don't own this place. I'm just telling you that it was an extreme. It was like having a lab at HRI to yourself, and it was the best thing you could ever imagine for your ability to absorb the truth in what's going on out here.
Mm-hmm.
That probably doesn't make sense, but...
No, it does. So, what changed?
Well, it's like that little Instagram deal. The little dog is sitting on a couch, and it says in a animated voice, uh-oh. And then someone says, what? And they say, people. You know? But people changed it. And then you have things that are natural that, you know, in the video that I did, it's just, I said, all the things that are wrong are not caused just by people. There are other factors in it too. You had the freezes of 83 and 89. You had the algae blooms all in between there that killed fish. You had man coming in here with his machinery and having little respect for what they were doing as far as damaging vegetation. Global warming is a real issue. The sea level rise changes the makeup of the vegetation. And I hate sea level rise. I do. I hate that term because it has so many political connotations to it. I mean, it's a fact. And what else? Probably I did. I probably had. Now, I know I had a negative impact on this deal. I did. By me walking out there, running my boat, doing things that are wrong. And then you see all of it going on and you think, I got to change some of this. So
what got you started in conservation?
Well, I guess if you got a biology degree, you think in terms of some of this stuff, at least in a peripheral sense. I never was a biologist. I just had a degree in it. But in the mid-70s, there was a force here of commercial fishing that took the resource and harvested it with gill nets and trot lines, and it became a people deal too. It became more and more and more of them as the market value increased. And they depleted the resource. I mean, it just was, I could go out here in 1974 and see fish everywhere I went. And then slowly in the next 3 or 4 years, you go like, well, where are the fish? They're gone. The water's here, when the fish aren't. So it became a pretty established fact that the commercial harvest was the reason. So I met, in 1977, I met a group of people in Houston at a boat show that formed the Gulf Coast Conservation Association. And I joined that group, and I'm not one to really sit on the sideline, I guess, so I jumped right in. And we decided, or they decided, it was Walter Fondren and other Dusty Rhodes. God, I met so many people that I'm, you know, a lot of them have passed on, but they were true conservationists, you know, with a single focus. And I joined them. I became very active in it. We went to Austin. We worked on bills to have trout and redfish declared game fish and taken off the commercial market. And we fought that fight for 3 years. And in 1981, we got it done. So that introduced me. I met Perry Bass, who's chairman emeritus of the Parks and Wildlife, and Bob Kemp, the famed biologist for the park. I met all of those people and I mingled with them. I mean, it was a different time. You talked, you didn't email, you know. So in that endeavor, I met game wardens up and down the coast, and I just can't believe how many people in this setting of conservation that I met during that time. And once we got it done, I slowly got to where I did other things. And that got me started in it. It got me thinking that you can go do things, you can work. If you work, you have the potential for reward.
Mm-hmm. more about kind of your work in Austin, trying to get redfish as a game fish?
Well, you know, when you don't know what you're doing, you get terribly naive. And in the legislative world, just because you're right doesn't mean you're going to get what you want. You have enemies. You have people who disagree with you usually for economic reasons, if nothing else. And I think it was disappointing. I just thought the old Superman deal, truth, justice, and the American way, would win. And that's not the way it is. And I think I was more disappointed in the process, but you get into the process, you fight through it, and you work around it, and you play the game, and I don't know really what to say about it. I mean, I'm proud of what we did. I think we gave the state and the resource a terrific gift. People don't even know this happened now. You know, they don't know that they're, you know, the people who are 40 years old have no idea what we did. And that's okay. But I don't know what else to say about it other than it was a task that I never felt like would turn into the battle that it turned into, with all the disappointments. And, you know, at the end you did high fives and went off and had cocktails and did all that mess. But
describe why was it a battle?
Pardon me. Well, there were vested interests in the ability to sell trout and redfish. Restaurants, the Texas Restaurant Association, the fish houses, the local chambers of commerce. There was a lot of people opposed. You know, people would have fish fries, you know, big fish fries to raise fundraisers. And so they would get the fin fish from a fish house to go have product for their fish fry. That's just an example of it. I mean, the Texas Restaurant Association, I mean, that was a big battle right there. There are a lot of restaurants that sell a lot of fish, so you're taking away their resource. And redfish farming was not in the game then. So there was a gap in their ability, you know. Famously, Governor Bill Clement, he was given the task of signing some of this stuff, and his comment was, "Tell with them, let them eat catfish." You know, that was really not a good thing to say politically at the time, but it was classic. Let them eat catfish. So,
can you tell me why they called it the Redfish Wars?
Sure. Well, redfish were at the front and center of it. The trout. And the trout and the redfish were the two big market items. So we came out with a program that said, save the redfish. I mean, what are you going to do? Say, save the redfish, the trout, the flounder, the, you know, so on. And so we, you know, it just had a ring to it. And it had a nice logo. So that became our mantra. And you know, the commercial fishermen it got ugly. I'm going to tell you, it got ugly. The breed of commercial fishermen back then were people embedded in the community that had done that all their lives. So we're threatening their way of life. The game wardens, and they were sneaky. They knew what they were doing. And they'd go out in the worst weather on earth and set their monofilament nets to garner all the fish in there. And the game wardens would go out and they'd play cat and mouse and hide and seek. And this wasn't any Mickey Mouse, "Oh, get out of my way, darling," deal. This was blood and guts. I had my house shot. I carried a pistol everywhere I went. I was a marked guy. I really was. I was head of the violation committee. So, you know, I talked at the parks and all. I did a lot of things. I debated on live TV, a commercial fisherman on Channel 2 News in Houston. So it was a war. It really was. And, you know, that's a good concise term for it, the Redfish Wars.
Mm-hmm. What did you do at the time? I mean, your house is getting shot?
Yeah, I had a house down here that was a weekend house. And across the street from me was a commercial fisherman. And he'd go get drunk. And he hated me. He really did. It was a funny, there were some funny stories that came out of it. His name was Jack Foote, F-O-O-T-E. He's deceased. He went on and moved to California and whatever. But these guys were, they were a diverse group of guys that you really didn't want to make mad. They'd probably all been to jail anyway, so they didn't care. But he set some, I got to back out here. There was another one here, a very famous commercial fisherman named Howard Brown. And Howard was, he was an Army Ranger or some deal. He was a very outspoken. He'd go to Austin, he'd testify and all that. And he and I did battle. And he became, after we passed this, he became a fishing guy. He took President Bush out just like I did. And so he had, before all that happened, he had taken his boat called the Angel B, was a little boat, and it was named after his wife. He had, his first boat was Angel, and his second boat was Angel B, a little skiff that, you know, they had dark skiffs. They didn't want to be seen at night, so they were all black. He went back in the back end of Copano where my house was, and he set all of his trot lines back there. So he comes back to run them, and they're all gone. They're cut. So Foote told him that I did it. So Howard goes to the Parks and Wildlife and files a complaint against me. So the game wardens come, and, you know, I was friends with all of them. You know, we had a lot in common, and Johnny Karstadt and some of those iconic game wardens back then. And Johnny said, "Chuck, I got to talk to you." And I said, "Sure, come on. What's the deal?" He said, "Well, I got a complaint filed against you." I said, "Oh, okay, by who?" And he said, "Well, Howard Brown." "What?" He said, "Yeah. Howard said you cut all of his trot lines." And I said, "Johnny, I didn't do that. And if I did, I'd be proud of it, and I'd tell you I did it." So he goes back to Howard and says, "Howard, Chuck didn't do that." So he went back. Jack Foote had done it, told him that I did it, so he and Jack Foote got in a fight. So it was childish stuff that today is funny to me anyway. I don't know.
Wow.
But it was a war, make no mistake about it. I had Jimmy Atkins, he had his cabin burned. I don't think anyone was ever shot over the deal. But there was a lot of stuff that could, you know, game wardens had their boats rammed. It was a war. I mean, we're in here stopping a lifestyle and a way of life. And so people are going to respond.
What was your argument at the time to shift for the game fishing? I mean, were you concerned about these guys? I mean, why push for the game fish?
Well, if we had tried for a while to impose some restrictions on their harvest, quotas and stuff like that. And they, I mean, none of that works. I mean, how are you going to enforce that? How are you going to keep people from sneaking out? If you got a house on Coconut Bay that's on the water and the right time comes and you just tootle out of your place and go net them, what the hell they get? Who's going to get you? So everything that was attempted didn't work. There was no deterrent on the people who were causing the problem. To go to game fish became, you had to, let me tell you, there were no fish here, okay? I mean, if I went out and spent a day on the water and saw, because my fishing is evolved into sight fishing, so I go look, okay? Man, that's a pretty good sampling and a pretty good idea of what's going on. Whereas I could go out and see 100 or 200 fish in a day and go, you see, hey man, today I saw five. You know, well, what are you going to do? Let the resource be depleted to zero? You know, which is not going to happen. But, you know, sport fishing is a huge industry. And it's vital to these coastal communities. It's harder to measure than the value of a commercial catch because that's more of a finite, recordable thing. But it became apparent that the only way we were going to stop this is put it in a category to where if there was a violation, it went to a different penal level. Okay? And so that was the tack that we took. And that's where it evolved, and that became a big bloodbath, and there were many, many stories about how this thing happened and got done. But the legislators were under a lot of pressure. I swore I'd never go back to Austin. I did. I mean, and here I am back in Austin. You know, 40-something years later, I'm doing it again. I'm going like, you're too old for this stuff. My golden years. Here's Chuck, he died in anger, you know.
So what happened after it? After everything kind of calmed down a little bit?
It settled down. A few of the guys become fishing guides. Howard was I loved old Howard Brown. We became friends. You know, if nothing else, we had respect for each other. And he was a colorful dude, to say the least. But it went on, you know, 3 years, and the population started coming back. We started building hatcheries. So many things were born out of that battle that carry on today. You know, the science was not advanced like it is today. So, you know, the question is, you know, will the natural hatch replenish the population? Or will we have to supplant it with hatchery fish? So we embark on a course to establish hatcheries to raise, and we did that with Dow Chemical in Freeport. They really got behind us and funded all of that study. It just evolved into a science of its own. And, you know, over time, a couple of years, it started rebounding.
Was it a pretty obvious rebound?
Yeah. You know, 6-pound fish don't rebound in a year. You know, that's a 5-year-old fish. Was it obvious to the point where you went out and you just stuck a thermometer in the whole deal visually and you said, oh, they're back? You know, no. I mean, this is all a gradual thing. Nothing happens in a hurry out here. You just, when you're here all the time, you know, you get a feeling of what's going on. But they weren't taking the smaller juvenile fish. So those were essentially here. What you did is lost the brood fish. Like I say, the science evolved and people learned that all of these fish are born offshore, you know, and they come in as larvae rather than being born in the bay, you know. So just an amazing epiphany in how we manage the resource now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So science at its finest.
Yes, definitely improved. How would you measure the fishing back then to today?
Back then, when? How far back? Keep in mind, I got a long, my backside is longer than my front side. So.
Well, once the populations rebounded.
Once?
Yeah, like in the 80s after.
Well, it gets, you know, land, water, mud. That was the title of my talk. That's where it gets all muddy. It's because we stopped the commercial take in 81. So it starts slowly rebounding. And it came, you know, actually it came back pretty quick. But in 2 years, we were catching keeper fish again. And then we hit the freeze of 83. And it killed them. I mean, deader than a hammer. You know, percentage-wise, I couldn't tell you. I mean, I can tell you that in my mind's eye and Parks and Wildlife data, the freeze of 2021 killed 40 to 50% of the fish. So I can't give you a percentage, but it killed a lot of fish. I mean, they were floating everywhere. So you go forward, then you have a setback. 2 or 3 years later, you have another population of fish. Then we had a red tide algae bloom that killed a lot of fish. And then they rebound. You know, it seems like to me about 2 or 3 year rebound time. And then we had the freeze of 89, which was horrible. I mean, St. Charles Bay froze completely over. I mean, you couldn't go ice skating on it, but you couldn't run your boat through there either. So it just, you know, and so it killed probably more, 89 killed more fish than probably 83 did. But the difference was the water got so cold for so long that the fish never decomposed. We were told that they just went to the bottom and that's where they were going to stay. You didn't see them. So the only way you can measure these things is by gill net surveys. And the Parks and Wildlife historically had a good gill net survey program, which was stepped up as a response to the redfish wars. So, you know, and a gill net survey has value when it's not same place, same time. So if you had a winter freeze, you had to wait for the spring for their gill net surveys, and they were all in and deciphered by July. So,
what got you into guiding?
You know, being raised in East Bernard in the outdoors, I didn't want to be in an office. I didn't. And things had gotten goofy, and I was in the insurance business, did a lot of other things, most of which didn't work out, but hell, at least I learned from them. But I learned, you know, the best day of my life was Friday when I was driving to Rockport, and the worst day was Sunday when I was going home. You know, it wasn't that I was going home to old what's her name. What is her name? So, I hope she's not listening. But you go, I was 48 years old, and I said, you know, the old saying, to thine own self be true, that if you're not, I wasn't happy. And if you're not happy, the people around you are not happy, and they're not doing as well as they could do if you were happy. So what's making you unhappy? And I said, leaving Rockport. I don't want to leave. So I just said, pardon me, to hell with it. I'm not doing this anymore. So I go home to Geet, and I said, I'm going to Rockport. And she said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm a guide, and I sure hope you can. And she said, okay. That was it. So we moved into our little house here, and we were fat, dumb, and happy, and 48 years old, and took long walks there. It was a great time. It really was. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted, Jay Watkins is a famous, wonderful guide, steward of the habitat here. And I know he grew up here in Rockport. And I envied him more than any person I've ever envied. I could go see him in Tackletown, and we'd talk, and I'd be Saturday, Sunday, whatever. And I think to myself, that scamp, when I leave here Monday, he's going to have this whole cockeyed thing to himself, and I can't let that happen anymore. So, you know, he did, Jay Watkins, he probably, I wish, someday I'll tell him. But he had more to do. But I just couldn't stand to have him have this whole place to himself, because I knew what it was. You know, in 90, I had this place figured out. But anyway, the pursuit of happiness, to the own self be true.
So, can you talk about why you formed Flatsworthy?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I know why I formed it. So I go through, when I came here and started in 92 full-time, started guiding early 93, somewhere in there. And so, yeah, I've already told you that I had God's laboratory. I had the whole place to myself. And I don't mean it that way, but it's the truth. And so you go from that to you slowly see the increase in people coming down here. And I'm all for it. I want people to say, okay, I'm not bitter about that. But you observe, when you don't have anything to do but fish, you think about all of these factors you put together. You know, I think that's where my biology came into, where I tried to combine in this land, water, mud deal. Never is an effect the result of one cause. It's everything in concert yields a product. I've tried to explain it, and I've come, the best analogy I can come up with, Jack Cohen, who's a famous artist like Herb Booth is, and some of the, you know, what they do is they take colors, and all the colors that there are, and they bring them back and they combine them into a depiction of what they have in their mind's eye. So that painting is a result of every little part, and it's the same thing out here on the water. That the result out here is a product of all of the component parts, all of the reasons, all of the factors. But taking answering your question is that I saw people coming in, I saw habits being formed, I saw, we had, you know what a school of fish is, we still had them. And there would be so many people on the water, and mainly led by guides who were not good stewards of this. They were not teachers. They were not leaders. They were takers. And you could get a school of 50 or 100 redfish, and they'd take 10 boats and surround them. Well, those fish will stay together as a defense mechanism. And they would surround those fish and throw cut mullet up in there and start catching them. And they caught every one of them. And you go like, well, these people are teaching their clients that this is acceptable behavior. And then people started running their boats everywhere, running over people, not physically, but interfering with the way they were fishing. And it just, I figured, you know, look, I'm going to be doing this for a while yet. So that took about 5 years from, I'd say from 2007 or 8, as an example, to 2012, 13, 14. That's when it just really got horrible. So I said, I can either go hide, or I can do something about this, or at least I can try. You know, the old saying, if you don't try, you won't win, and if you don't quit, you won't lose. So I said, I'm going to start a dialogue. So I called 12 people together, and we went and had a meeting, and there were people, Jay Watkins and others from different user groups. I said, are you guys happy with what's going on? No. I mean, I had kayakers, airboat, I had the whole gamut. And I said, look, I can't do this anymore. I can't take it, and we got to start talking about it, and we got to start working on it. So they all agreed, and that's, you know, when that came together, then I said, well, I got to have a group. So I called a friend of mine, and I said, he was a graphic artist, and I said, I have some help. And so he came up, Dan Glidden is his name. He came up with the name Flatsworthy and the logo, and there you go. A star was born. Not me, but Flatsworthy, you know. I mean, nobody else was doing this. Nobody was talking about it. There was no dialogue. It was all grumbling. It was all gnashing of teeth. And, you know, this is supposed to be a happy place. It's supposed to be a happy, healthy environment for people to come enjoy. And you can be aggressive catching fish. That didn't have anything to do with it. It just, I coined a phrase, and it's called jackassery. And that's what was going on. It was an extreme case of bad jackassery out here.
Can you explain, like, what you mean by that, what people were doing?
If I was in a cove, and I'm fishing that cove, and two people come idling up to me and start fishing it because they saw me there, and not me, I'm an example, okay? Encroachment, a guy fishing in a boat, and you're supposed to maintain a distance, okay? If you're running, a guy's on a shoreline, let's say he's 30 yards off the bank, and he's fishing, and you go run your boat within 20 yards of him, well, you cooked his fishing. People were running shorelines where they just get up on the shoreline and run right down that shoreline looking for fish. When you do that, you alter the fish in there for the rest of that day. It's not going to recover until tomorrow. People would be in the tidal lakes and, oh gosh, I mean, there's so many examples of just being insensitive to the ability of someone else to have a quality day. I came up with a deal. I said, don't do things in your fishing that are unnecessary to your success that diminishes someone else's success. You have to think.
What do you think it was about that time, why it increased?
Well, that's I don't know that I can answer that, except that I'll answer it this way. I'm asked, what's the difference between the freeze of 83, 89, and 2021? And I said, my answer was, the level of sportsmanship in the fishermen. That in 83 and 89, the culture of fishermen was far different than it is today. The degree of stewardship, I mean, it's takers. I'm gonna be successful at all cost. To heck with my fellow angler. And that culture comes from people who enter the sport with no prior history of it. There was a deal here. I think one of the worst things that ever happened to the coast was the redfish tournaments, where they came in and, you know, it was go catch a fish, one, you know, at all cost, using any means or method. And so it taught people a lot of bad habits in terms of the way they operated their vessels, what that they had no, I mean, it became a big money deal. And so whenever you throw that into it, then you, oh gosh, I just ought to be quiet on this deal, but I mean, they put on their clown suits and decals and, you know, it's like self-promotion, you know, I mean, so anyway, I'm gonna be quiet there. Not, you know, I saw it coming. And I had, I from the beginning, I had been asked to do this. I'm going like, stick a finger in my mouth. I can't do this. I'm out. But things like that had, you know, all of the things, like I said, all of these factors came together. It's not one thing. It's everything in concert that's yielded this culture.
So can you talk more about the goals and activities of Flatworthy, how you're trying to change that culture?
Well, I think what we tried to do was to create a dialogue for the first time. You know, the first step in solving a problem is realizing that you got one, right? And so that was the early attempt, was to establish the fact that we've got a problem in the way we're accessing all of this. That, so we did that public meetings, and, you know, people hear what they want to hear. Never, ever in here will you find anything in Flatsworthy that tells you not to do something. Okay? I'm going to suggest that there are better ways to do things, but you go do it. You go where you want to, when you want to. I don't want to tell you that, because I don't want anybody telling me that. I don't want to throttle on me. But I don't mind hearing that, due to the fact that this resource has been utilized so greatly, that we need to rethink some of these things. There's nothing wrong with that. But people misunderstand what you say. They hear what they want to hear. And they were accusing me of telling them, you can't do this and you can't do that. You know, where did I ever say that? Where is it in writing? Where is it in my words? So, you know, people say, you'll never change this. And no, I won't unless I try, and I won't lose unless I quit. And so by the mere, I've won this deal. People, I have won this deal, declared myself a victor that has more things to do. Because that narrative is there. People did not think about what they were doing prior to what Flatsworthy did. They didn't think about it. And now collectively, it's part of the thought. I mean, I see it, I hear it, people tell me all the time, you've made this a better place. And you're not gonna get everybody to go along with this. Don't try. You know, if I got 15 detractors, do I spend my time trying to bump heads with them, or do I go find the 100 people that want to know how to do it right? So you pick, you tell me where I'm going to go. So we did all kinds of things. I've been everywhere, talked everywhere, had articles everywhere. But then Harvey came. And Harvey totally changed the pathway. We couldn't have public meetings. It put a 9-month time out on what we were doing. But it gave me a chance. I had met enough people, Katie Swanson at UTMSI and others. I mean, I knew a lot of people in all of your institutions. And I thought, I thought, I'm not gonna waste this time. I'm going to go and expand my relationships.
Do you want to take a break, or how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Okay.
I mean, it's up to you. I'm gonna expand. If I lose my train of thought, never will come back to it. But it was enough. I took and expanded the things I did and met new people like Texas Sea Grant. I mean, just on and on and on. I feel like I know everybody. And I wanted to establish a great relationship with them. And those come from being consistent, open, and honest with people. And by also doing what you say you're going to do. So then that gave us the ability to move away from the social etiquette side to the resource etiquette. And so we actually have probably spent more time on the resource etiquette, prop damage, prop scoring, you know, other things. Of course, the oyster deal has been one of my programs for a good while. We did the vegetation video, which was one of my dreams. And now we're doing etiquette video on boating etiquette. So while we have a lot of things working, you know, and that's the focus of Flatsworthy. It is the educational side through videos, dialogue, resource, personal, and then bingo, youth. So that's the four corners of my square right there.
How did you develop that over time?
Huh?
I mean, where did the ideas come from?
Oh, I guess come home and have a scotch at 5, another one at 5:15, and then eat and go to sleep and wake up at 2 o'clock fairly rested and your mind's clear. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with my point in time in my life. When you're your age, you have your timeline. And I told those kids, I said, you know, y'all think 20 years, 25 years. I'm thinking 3 and 4. I don't have 20 years. So, and I'm pretty impatient. If I'm going to work on something, I want to see it happen. So I have a different grind level. I have an opportunity to make a difference. And if I don't, then I've squandered something. I can't fix all of this stuff. There's no way. But I can fix some of it. And that's a hell of a lot better than fixing none of it. And I love people. And if you don't love me, I don't love you. I love being around like-minded, intelligent, gifted people who are doers. And I've met people from every walk of life in this state over the last 45 years. I know them, okay? I listen to what they say. I analyze what they can do. And I go off and I replay that. And I like the lady from HRI that sent a request to me. Well, I connected her to Ashley Bennis and Dr. John Pettigrove. They can answer her questions. And so that's a fun deal. It doesn't cost any money. It takes a lot of time. The only aggravating thing about it is these cockeyed emails get lost in these threads. I'm just so old-fashioned. I just hate myself. I don't want to know how to operate this thing, but I got to. But that's really a fun deal, connecting people who can go off and accomplish something meaningful together. It is. And I think I'm okay at it. I don't know how I do it. I really don't. But by God, if you come to me with a question and it's one that needs involvement, I can connect you to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Why do you want to get kids involved?
Okay, so if we go off and do this work and we accomplish something, and none of these things that we try to accomplish have immediate impact, okay? So, you know, forget that. I mean, they're going to have an accumulative effect in a positive way over time, given enough people who accept what you're trying to do. So, and a lot of people that help me are my age, and but more are younger. But if we go do this and we don't have people to carry on 25 years from now, what have we done? It's going to all be for naught. The kids, I'm overwhelmed with the value of that decision to bring them into the program, and not in some condescending way. But you're on my board, and you come to board meetings, and you speak, and we'll listen. And you've got to know that you have value and worth, and that you're welcome into this. And, hell, I don't know what else to say about it. I've set a lot of precedent with the Texas AgriLife people, with the Sea Grant people, with the county extension agents. It's just a win deal. So, and it's heartwarming to be able to go out and find kids who have the wherewithal to come speak to a bunch of adults that they have never seen before, and make a contribution by what they're saying. It's amazing. So if you don't look for these things, you're not going to find them. But it's like I told those graduate students, you're not going to answer anything sitting in the lab. You got to get off your butt and get out here and go meet people. Then when you do, when you go through those portals, ideas, creative ideas will come to you about how you can make that worthwhile. So I don't know, I'm rambling now, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we sponsored a kids fish deal here last year, 5 counties. This year it's going to be 18.
Oh, wow.
So tell me that doesn't have value.
Tell me about these kids fishing days.
Well, that's kind of the name for the deal, but what we do, I guess there's two sides of this. We support the local 4-H clubs in that if they want to take 10 kids to the dock and have them fish all the time, we do that. We support that and buy them bait or whatever, you know. But the kid fish day here is you take Parks and Wildlife, you take the AgriLife people in by themselves or educated in all this, Texas Sea Grant, you take all of these agencies, and in a day's time, you expose them to what a biologist does. You expose them to Texas Parks and Wildlife enforcement people. You just all aspects of marine life, you give them an opportunity to experience. It's in the water, you teach them kayaking, you just do the everything. It's a little one day mini circus, you know.
I bet the kids have fun.
Well, they do. It's a great thing to go to. It is.
What do they say about it, the kids?
Oh, I got pictures around here where they're wearing Flatsworthy shirts and, oh, they're excited. They are. I mean, it's like taking them to the carnival. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great deal.
Okay, tell me about oysters.
Oh.
Or unless you need a break.
Is it, huh? No. Well, you need coffee or water? You need some water?
I'm good.
Okay. God, that's, how much time do you have?
All day.
All right, so I think I said in the talk the other day that I had, in all of my deals out here, I had come to the conclusion that the most important factor was the vegetation that we had. It was responsible for water quality and, you know, habitat for game fish, sport fish, bait fish, all microorganisms. And then, you know, I used to have to navigate, if I went from the mouth of St. Charles Bay, which is right here, and jogged across to Spalding Bay or Carlos Bay, which are two areas to the east, I had to worry about where I was because of the reef structure. And all of a sudden I think, well, I don't have to do that anymore. What happened? And simultaneously, I see the water quality diminishing. And this is a couple of years ago when I started this. So in that, you know, in my vegetation video, I talked about erosion and change and what had happened in the evolution of the vegetation on San Jose Island. And I know for a fact that part of that is due to the differential in the water depth, which is, if you talk about the sea level rise factor and global warming and all of that, we're not gaining 5 feet of water down here, we're gaining 3 inches. But at the same time, if you lose your vegetation, then you increase the rate of erosion. So you're gaining water from two areas, loss of bottom and an increase in the top. So that, and then there's another deal in here that is hyper interesting. We had a water level in 2016 and 2017, and it's a very complicated deal, but water level fluctuates seasonally. High in the spring, low in the summer, high in the fall, low in the winter. And that determines access of the oyster harvest boats to the resource. They have to be able to take their boat on top of the reef to harvest it. So in the winter low tide, they could not do that. Well, in 2016, that water level never left. And I was amazed that this water stayed in here like the fall tide. Well, it's here all year long. It came from the spring high tide, never left during the summer, never left during the winter. So those boats could access the top of these reefs that they'd never been able to harvest before. And there's a little bay up here, St. Charles Bay. It's a nursery bay, a minor bay, major impact, major importance. And they had never oystered that before. I drove down to the end of my road and counted 74 oyster boats. They destroyed St. Charles Bay. And I'm not talking about a little bit. They destroyed the whole basis of that being a nursery bay. They destroyed the reefs that were at the mouth. I mean, it's destroyed. And so when I go and I look at all these other things, all of these other reefs, Thompson's Towhead, Scotch Tom Reef, Jaybird Reef, you just go on and on and on, and you go like, they're gone. Those people have gone in and removed, and now you're going to get real technical here. The value of the reef has to do with its vertical height above the bottom. And the value, oyster filter feeder, every oyster, 50 gallons of oyster a day, of water a day is what it filters. When it's at its optimum filtering capability, and that has everything to do with its relationship to the surface. In other words, an oyster in 8 feet of water will not be as effective as an oyster in 3 inches of water. It has everything to do with the velocity of the water across. So, it's just a whole lot of mumbo jumbo here, but it's all fact. And I read it a stack of scientific writings over here that I've learned how to read those. You read the abstract and then you read the conclusion and you left the middle alone, because it's stuff you don't know anything about. But I did. And then being with Jennifer, that dialogue, but I realized that the water's worse, the fishing has been altered, the flow of water has been altered. I went and talked to Dr. Christopher Mace, who was then the oyster man with Parks and Wildlife here. And we talked about some of these things. And on his wall, I guess this is how my demented mind works, was a satellite image of this area in here. And it had, there's a progression of reefs, second chain island, Ayers Reef, third chain island, Cedar Reef, and Carlos Reef. And I looked at that, and of course I knew where they were. I'd walked every one of those things. But I noticed that they spanned the water from the barrier islands of Matagorda and San Jose Island to the mainland. And they were, in the winter it'd be out of the water. And one of the things I've always noticed is that on some of these winds, and they're prevailing winds a lot of times, the flow of water out of San Antonio Bay coming, I call it the Straits of Mesquite, where you have narrowing in there that you go San Antonio Bay, Mesquite Bay, Carlos Bay, and Aransas Bay. And that as that water surges through there, the rate of erosion is heightened. And that the value of those reefs, that's where I came up with baffle reef. What they are is a baffle in the flow and interchange of water coming out of San Antonio Bay into Aransas Bay. And so after 2016 into 2017, and after Harvey, second chain of islands was destroyed, third chain of islands was destroyed, and Carlos Reef was destroyed by the oyster harvest. Harvey did have an impact in that, to a degree that I, maybe not factually, but I consider it to be minor compared to the destruction of the harvest. Ayers Reef and Cedar Reef were at a different level in their structure, their height above the bottom, than the second chain, third chain, and Carlos Reef. So even with the increased water level of 2016 that carried over into the 2017 harvest time, they were still intact. And I said, if we lose those, this whole area is going to be changed forever. San Jose Island is going to be horribly destroyed, changed, and the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge is too. We're going to lose those. We're going to lose those sensitive marsh areas. Your water's going to rush through here, and once erosion gets started, buddy, there's no turning back. So I said, late one night, I got up and I said, I'm calling on Baffle Reefs and I'm going to write a paper on it. And so it just, I could not leave it alone. I had to, even though I'm sitting here in Lamar, fat, dumb, and happy, and not terribly educated in all of this stuff, it's all observational stuff. I don't care if somebody laughs at me, I don't care, hell with it. I wrote a lot of other things, Who's Mother Nature's Mother, The Saltwater Porcupine, on and on and on. I guess that when you get older, you don't care. If you feel like you're doing the right thing, to hell with the criticism. So, how could you not do anything about it? And I guess it's just the way I am. So the oyster deal is I never could understand it. I couldn't understand. You come from a farming background, and I do too, okay? I harvested, I drove cotton bines, I drove cotton pickers, all that's wonderful heritage. But how can you have a crop that's a public crop and have the people that harvest it determine how they do it? And how can you do that? It just, I don't know, you know, this, all of this stuff started back in the 50s when Parker Brothers and some of these other people came in and harvested all this shale for road material. That really had a huge impact on this whole deal. So, well, look at old what's-her-name bringing in a cookie.
Hi. Sure. Thank you.
That's the best.
Just set them over there for now. I'll cough and choke and gag if I'm on a roll. So.
Thanks.
So, anyway, where were we? Before the Cookie Monster came in.
Private oystermen deciding how they oyster public resources.
Yes. Yes. What do we owe them? You know, why? What's different about oysters than it is about trees in a state forest? What's different about it? What's so provincial in all this deal that they have some inherent right to, well, we don't owe them a living. You know, nobody owes me a living. I mean, I'm a fishing guy and I'm in the water, you know, so it's just, it came from, a lot of this mindset came from when there was such an uproar over the harvest. And that was in Galveston Bay, and it was also in San Antonio Bay, Hines Bay. When they went in, they had to make some concessions, and I mean, it's all, I've talked to people whose daddy was an attorney on this and helped drive them, go like, I don't even want to hear this. I don't want to hear about stuff that has no logic to it. You know, just, let's get this thing changed, and I'm going to focus on that. You know, looking back, you look at why we're where we are, and it's definitely, as far as I'm concerned, I've stated this publicly, it's mismanagement. And there's a lot of culpability in here to people that I love. And I love the Parks and Wildlife. I'm going to leave it there.
Not
that I'm afraid, but I've already called out everybody that needs to be called out. Let's do it.
What would you like to see happen with the oysters?
I would like to see, here's my, I would like to see the establishment of sanctuary reefs. Now keep in mind, I'm talking about public reefs. Public. That's a big word. Why do citizens have exclusive rights to harvest a public resource? Now I'll just leave it there. What I would like to see is, and what I've asked for in my Baffle Reef deal and what Jenny is studying, the establishment and the rescue, the salvation, the declaration of Ayers and Cedar Reef as sanctuary reefs. You'll never harvest off of these reefs. They become sanctuaries to establish and save those two baffles. The cost of rehabilitation of second chain, third chain, and Carlos is cost prohibitive. And not only that, but the time involved in the structural recreation of those, you know, none of us are going to live long enough to see that. I mean, that's 50 years. These reefs are ancient, ancient, ancient. What I want to see is the creation of sanctuary reefs to control the flow of water and the rate of the velocity of the water, to enhance the filtration capabilities of the lowly oyster. I want to see a harvest that is sustainable. I want to see the advancement of mariculture. This is just me talking, and I've talked to some people. There are local people who backtrack. The industry has oligarchs. There's about five families that essentially control what's going on. They have financial capabilities. They were all given settlements from the BP spill. So they're, you know, these are people with resources. Then you have a group of people who are the salt of the earth. Let's just say you have haves and have-nots, okay? I don't want to interfere with anybody's life. I will to protect the resource. But I personally would like to go to them and say, look, and they're identifiable, okay? You don't have to do a poll, or you don't have to go do any kind of whatever to figure out who they are. I can find out who they are. And go to them and say, look, do you want to become involved in oyster mariculture? And depending upon their answer, I'd really like to say, look, do you have the resources to do that? And the answer is going to be no. And I would like to tell them, I would like to make a statement. If you do, then we're going to help you find the money and the technical ability to go do this. That's what I want out of this deal.
I don't. You've given me a lot to think about here.
I'm sorry.
No, that's but okay. That's,
well, I mean, I don't want to be the bad guy. But I really do. I want to do that.
It sounds like a win-win, right?
It is a win-win. You know, you get in your attempt to do something that has to be done. It's going to be a war. It doesn't have to be so cruel as to find to hurt people that are sitting on the sideline that have no influence in this deal. They're just going to be a victim of what goes on. So I think, and I've told people on my side, I mean, if you want to do something PR-wise, why don't you think about doing this? And so if somebody says, well, you just have to stop the oyster man, well, full corn. You know? It's not their fault entirely. They have not had any guidance. You know, it's more a management problem of the Parks and Wildlife than it is these guys out here working every day. I mean, hell, nobody told them not to do it. Okay? If you got a picnic table in your backyard under the trees and it's got squirrels in it, and you go put 100 pecans out there this afternoon, you leave them overnight, they're going to be gone. It's up to the people who own the cons to determine how many are put on the table and the harvest, and that has not been done.
Tell me, what's your most memorable experience out fishing on the bays?
Oh gosh. I couldn't tell it.
What about your most memorable experience guiding?
Well, I couldn't tell that. No. Oh, Lord. So I had, I don't know how I can tell this. How much time can we pause here? Yeah. I got to get my composure.
Sure, let's take a little break.
No, let's don't.
Okay.
So I just got to get a hold of myself. So I had a Fred Dobbs was a head Dobbs container from Dallas, and he was a class guy. And he had a beautiful wife. I mean, she was just a beautiful person, okay? So she comes down with cancer and she's terminal, and he wanted to take her fishing again. So it was in the winter, and he didn't have the luxury of waiting till the summer. So we go, I don't remember if it was probably December. And there's a beautiful place in the back end of San, I'll tell the story backwards. There's a beautiful place in the back of, very secluded in the back of San Antonio, St. Charles Bay. And it was the perfect place to go on the wind and the water level. A beautiful ride back there. And I just said, this is where I'm going to take them. There would be no people, there'd be hooping cranes. I mean, it's just going to be in a good setting. So we sat out here. It got so foggy. We left Goose Island State Park and got out here, and it got foggy. And I said, well, we're just going to wait this out. I'm not running in this fog. I'm not going to risk them. I mean, I would have done it myself in Newport, but I'm not going to do that. So we anchor up, and we sit, and we talk, and not only everything's kind of lighten up. And so I said, well, I can find it now. So go back there, and I swear to God, the clouds parted. I mean, it got beautiful. And I get on that reef, and I start, she couldn't wade, so, and we were in the boat, and we caught fish till hell wouldn't have it. And the clouds come back, and the fish quit biting. God gave it to her.
What an experience.
I'm sorry.
You're okay.
Next question.
Well, I think that was all my questions, but is there anything you wanted to talk about in terms of fishing or conservation that we didn't cover?
Oh, no. I mean, there's so many things. Yeah, I haven't got enough time. I don't know. I just think I hope in the end that I've made this place better than it was going to be. And it's a... All of these relationships that I have, I value. I do. Our brief time here together has true meaning to me. And all of the people that I meet, they're in my library of, they're in my vault of gold. They're golden. And I want I like all of these relationships to be ongoing. I like them to be vibrant and alive. And I want people to think that they can criticize me, correct me, give me due direction. I welcome all of that. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing. I haven't got a clue. I know why I'm doing it, but I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm just going to do.
I think you're exaggerating about that. I think you know what you're doing.
There's so many things. There's so many tentacles on this octopus that, I mean, it is. You stop and think about, I mean, it's dizzying. That I open so many avenues of golden opportunities on Wednesday that it's overwhelming. I have to see that they're followed through. I'm supposed to get an email list of those students that were there. And I want to do that again. I want to meet with them again. I want to establish a chapter in Heart Research, their chapter, give them a platform to express themselves, get them out of the lab, into the streets, go, I do. I mean, it's just, God, their eyes and their attention and their questions, that just, I wouldn't take for these experiences. I wouldn't. I don't know.
Well, if that you don't being, have anything to add, I'll turn off the recorder.
I don't know.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today and sharing that beautiful story.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. I do.
Thank you.